fact, I'm purposefully switching off my microphone in case I say anything objectionable. It won't be recorded for posterity. Actually, if you haven't checked out ELI's website, you can actually go back to the previous stakeholder forums and listen to the transactions of those groups there. And it's also possible to download all of the information from the site. But it is sometimes interesting, and you'll experience it firsthand here, to see what the interplay is. And some of the sessions in particular from the stakeholder forums of past years were particularly lively and a good point of reference for folks. I wanted to start off this morning with a brief mention of the first couple of lines from the National Wetlands Mitigation Action Plan, which was signed on Christmas Eve, miracle bit of driving around Washington, D.C. to get six political signatures on Christmas Eve. But we put together a plan which has helped set the direction for the federal agencies in terms of mitigation for the past year and a half, and a tremendous amount of work has gone into this, the formulation of this plan, and in the process of keeping tabs on it. We have convened stakeholders on a basis annually to make sure that we're touching base with constituencies out there on the progress on the plan. But the thing that I wanted to note was draw a little comparison between how we opened this a mere 18 months ago and an announcement from last month. But the Bush administration affirms its commitment to the goal of no net loss of the nation's wetlands. The administration is hopeful of achieving that goal in the near future to begin increasing our wetlands through the combined efforts of numerous governmental programs and initiatives, including the Clean Water Act, and non-regulatory wetland conservation initiatives and partnerships among federal agencies, state, tribal, and local governments. Fast forward to April of this year, and the President of the United States made as the centerpiece of his Earth Day announcement the fact that we will now be moving beyond no net loss goal to adding 3 million acres of restored, enhanced, and protected wetlands over the next 5 years. And I think it's a wonderful tribute to folks that are not only working in the federal system, but in the wetlands program, state, local, tribal, levels of government, that this issue has attained such prominence in this administration. And regardless of where your political proclivities lie, this is a wonderful statement of support for the wetlands program, and it's something that I think we are going to be able to build on quite a bit in terms of our work, not only in this session, but the remainder of the Mitigation Action Plan and in the wetlands program more generally. Bob and I are going to tag team a little bit here this morning and talk a little bit about the larger goals of our session today. Bob is going to try to keep you on target with some of the specific objectives in the latter half of this brief presentation. And Palmer and company have allowed me a little flexibility to talk about some of the context and perspectives that guide the work that we're doing. First off, as most of you know, the National Mitigation Action Plan contained 17 action items that the federal agencies were interested in implementing by the year 2005. And the overarching goal was to improve the effectiveness of compensatory mitigation, in particular to achieve no net loss and, where possible, to provide for the technical and other guidance that will support the restoration of other wetlands, whether or not they're in the context of a regulatory program. There were four major categories of actions that were elucidated in the Mitigation Action Plan, and they dealt with several areas that had been highlighted by the National Academy of Sciences, National Research Council evaluation that was completed in 2001 and also informed by the General Accounting Office's study on in-lieu fee mitigation, as well as several other efforts that have come out regarding work that ELI has done, previous compilations of mitigation success that IWR has spearheaded. Improving accountability, a key area. We have a number of action items that talk about tracking and measurement and assessment. Clarifying performance standards, definitely a large comment that came out of particularly the NAS study, was the desire to move beyond just stem counts after year two as a way of identifying whether or not a mitigation project was succeeding. Improving data collection and availability, tremendous strides going on there, particularly with respect to some work that the Corps is doing, and I'm sure we'll hear a little bit more about that later in the session here. Integrating commensurate mitigation into watershed context. And of course, this is the overarching area that we'll be focusing on today. Specifically, under that theme of integrating mitigation into a watershed context, we're working on three precursor documents, as I call them, that will lead to a resource in 2005 that is the focus of the three-day session here. These precursors include looking at the circumstances in which on-site versus off-site and in-kind versus out-of-kind mitigation are preferable. This is a document now that's out on the Mitigation Action Plan website for public comment, and we've already gotten a few comments in, and we anticipate that as the extended comment period deadline closes this first week of June, I guess it is, June 6th, that will have a significant contribution of public comments on that document. The second one is one that's in a little more preliminary stage, document on vegetated buffers and the use of those as potential mitigation. Third is the appropriate use of preservation for compensatory mitigation. And these latter two documents are ones that have been touched on in such previous work as mitigation banking guidelines, but have been in great need of some expanded discussion. Those will also be made available and would be circulated definitely prior to our upcoming stakeholder meeting in Tampa in September. Well, all of these are components that will contribute to a larger document that is designed to really get at what are the criteria for putting in place mitigation in a watershed context. And I think this has been something that has been done by many folks on an ad hoc basis for some time now, but there's been very little that has translated the science to the practical application that is faced in a 404 permitting context or, quite frankly, in identifying good restoration sites. And so, in particular, this objective here and the meeting here is one in which I have hopefully not too high expectations of, but I think this is the sort of gathering that really offers a tremendous amount of promise, particularly from my perch in the regulatory program. Specifically, the charge that we have is to identify criteria for making mitigation decisions in a watershed context. And specifically here, as quoted from the plan, are some guiding features of that. That it's not only supposed to identify what is going to have the greatest benefit for and probability for long-term survival, but it also will help decision makers utilize the planning tools that are already developed. And this is a really important point, and it's another reason why I'm very excited about this particular gathering, and that is we're really forcing the experts with scientific knowledge on restoration of wetlands into the same room with the permit writers and the folks that day-to-day are faced with making the work that's done here over the next 3 days. I cannot underestimate in terms of its future utility for not only the Section 404 program, but for several other efforts that I'll touch on as well. And this is my final slide before I kick it over to Bob. But a little bit of perspective and context here. Obviously, we are working on a project now that we hope by the end of 2005 is going to prove an invaluable resource to who are in the field as regulators right now and our mitigation providers identifying sites to place restored wetlands on the landscape. But beyond that, there's also a large group of folks that are very concerned about watershed issues in general and are ones that we can look to as potential resources as well as potential future customers of this effort that we're undertaking here today. And in particular, there are a wide network of local watershed organizations that are out there right now. And many of them have excellent intentions. A number of them even have dollars. But what is missing in some cases and in many cases is some comprehensive understanding of the watershed that they are operating in and some comprehensive understanding of where we would get the biggest bang for our buck to put wetlands back on the landscape. In terms of some of the efforts that are defining these other stakeholders out there, I alluded briefly to the work that the Corps is doing in terms of updating its database, the transition from RAMS, as folks may know it, to ORM, and some wonderful work that is going on there that is going to allow not only work that will support tracking permit actions and mitigation, but will also help us move to an effort that has been a priority of Mark's, which is watershed-based permitting and actually making decisions in a watershed context. So the implications of the work in this three-day session, as well as for the final map product in a year or so, go far beyond just identifying mitigation for mitigation's sake, but also for moving not only the Clean Water Act Section 404 program into a watershed approach, but perhaps other programs as well. Some of you may be familiar with a publication from EPA that is describes the watershed-based approach to NPDES permitting. And this is something that I don't think is that far off, particularly if we're successful here in this session and with this effort, would not be for the 404 program as well. And I think there's a lot that can be gained there. The other, yes, NPDES, the National Pollution Discharge Elimination System. The 402 program, yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll do that. The other thing that I want to emphasize is that we have some dollars out there. Now, the wetlands program in particular has never been one that has been particularly flawed with funding for these sorts of efforts. However, there are both EPA and other agencies that are viewing the water resource protection more in line with our objectives in the wetlands program in terms of everything from source water protection to achieving TMDL limits to dealing with the hypoxia problem in the Gulf. And as a result, increasingly, folks are opening up some of the more traditional water funding sources to wetlands restoration when it's done in that context. And again, the watershed framework is what brings these items together. And just briefly to mention a few, the Clean Water Act State Revolving Funds, $1.7 billion as of 2003. $238 million via grants for our non-point source programs, $30 million in grants for targeted watershed areas. All of these programs have examples of where they have used funding to help put wetlands back in the landscape as a part of a broader watershed effort. And I think that folks need to be aware of the not only the funding opportunities, but opportunities for mutual advancement of our objectives. Some of those future opportunities and linkages, just to name a few, source water protection, non-point source management, TMDLs, the NEP programs, essential fish habitat, state and local planning, all of these areas there are opportunities for some combined efforts on our part. The final bullet there, the stars are aligned. I've now been in the 404 program for 14 years, and never before have I seen the pieces in place to do something like what we propose to undertake now. A year after I started work, one of the items that plopped on our agenda and was raised in discussions with the Corps of Engineers is, how can we in a watershed manner? What can we do in hopping on this new watershed bandwagon? A white paper here, a little discussion here, a little grant over here. Nothing ever really materialized in terms of a comprehensive way of bringing the 404 program into a watershed context. And in my mind, for the first time, we now have the technology, GIS systems and other things that make the information gathering feasible for the type of work that's done on the Section 404 program. We have the political will, a signed mitigation action plan document, and a desire on the part of the president and everyone on down to focus on wetland restoration as a chief priority for the environmental issues for right now. Public awareness. There are now several thousand watershed groups that are out there on the ground. Some of them have a bit of a track record now, and there's some experience that can be brought to bear. The scientific community has come to the fore in not only recognizing the contributions that that wetlands make, but in providing some of the underlying knowledge base that we need to do this in a smart way. Partnerships are now being taken much more seriously, certainly by the federal agencies, with local governments, states, and tribes. And then financially, there are new opportunities for us to use funds not only that have historically been targeted to the wetlands program, but those that have been targeted to other areas. So I am, well, you can talk to Palmer and Tracy. I'm normally an optimistic person, but I'm extremely optimistic that this group here is going to really set us on a wonderful path, not only in successfully completing this mitigation action plan product, but in broadening our relationships with other watershed efforts that are out there and leading the way through this effort, leading the way to watershed permitting for the 404 program and to truly integrating the Clean Water Act for approach. So I'll leave it at that and pass it on to Bob.
Read their research and other efforts. I think it's a rather august group in terms of experts in science, experts in applied science, and experts in agency implementation. And I haven't been in a room with this mix and this pedigree in some time, so I want to thank ELI for getting you all here. I'm eager to hear the dialogue. I'm eager to participate in the dialogue. I thank you for the opportunity. We're here for the purpose of providing a mitigation action plan work group with direction and input. And what the heck does that mean? Well, I'm going to make a couple of assumptions, and I hope you would agree with these assumptions. One, that that many, if not most people, are interested in the quality of their watersheds. And a second assumption is that there's a lot of information out there. We have a lot of data. We have a lot of knowledge and information that can help us or inform a watershed management or management of aquatic resources in a watershed scale or framework. But the third thing is that often there is no identified view of option or options by which to help us inform how we make decisions, including regulatory decisions. So we have the first two and not the latter. Why is that the case? Well, I think that the decisions or series of decisions that are required to arrive at solutions tend to be site-specific. They tend to be not generalized to all watersheds, whether from the Willamette or to the Anacostia and all those that are in between in quality, although I I would hasten to say I would assume the Willamette and the Anacostia are not the extremes in terms of the quality of the watershed by however you would define it. And they could agree that watershed solutions depend on site-specific problems, issues. They deal with the physical attributes, the socioeconomic attributes, and so forth, the values of those in the watershed. So what we're going to try to do here is develop a logic or the elements of a logic that can inform the nation or inform the developers of a guidance. And enough so that it helps y'all that are out in these watersheds rather than hinders development and of a watershed approach when it comes to regulatory decision making. So we've structured this to identify criteria from that's going to be informed by discussion, drawing from the examples that you're going to provide and we will subsequently discuss. The desired outcomes. Well, first, what does science say about watersheds? The NRC report mentioned a couple of things. It talked about location and the watershed in terms of functions and so forth. It also talked about a little bit about geographic scale, the geographic basis and scale of decisions. We'll have a discussion on what science tells us about functions and location, watershed. What can science tell us that to help us come up with a logic for watershed-based decisions? We're going to take a look at the logical steps of a watershed-based approach to compensatory mitigation. This is a very fluid subject, or dynamic subject, I should say. And so we put clarify up there, meaning modify possibly, because we initially borrowed this from Joy Zedler, who had four elements or steps, if you will, of a watershed logic, and it included assessment, site prioritization, and so forth. We've modified that to five, and indeed five elements or steps. And indeed, if you look at, I think it's page somewhere in the back of your document. Let me see. I have the page written down here somewhere. 81 is what my memory tells me. Somewhere we have.
Looking for an article?
Yeah, it identifies six, I should say. So what that seemed to mean is that we all have different views, and this is what we're going to discuss. What are the things that are the logical steps or elements in a watershed-based approach? It's in the literature review section. I think there are six steps identified in that. I just forgotten the page number on that. So we'll take a look at that. Page 81, yes. And so we're going to take a look at the criteria that some of you have developed to deal with the specific problems in the watershed you face. So we're going to discuss those and see what we can learn from those in terms of informing a national logic. More desired outcomes. We have a lot that we're expecting of us all. That is the potential for use of some of the tools that you're now using, methods, analytical approaches. A number of decision support methods, if you will, a number of different tools that you've used to come up with criteria. We're going to take a look at those and with that, and especially I think with the help of that document that ELI has put together, provide a compendium or nice resource for others to borrow from to see from essentially A to Z how you got there and to be able to make some judgments as to the appropriateness of use in specific situation. And also then to discuss information level needed to effectively use. What do you really need to know? Back in the mid-90s, I took a quick look at SAMPs around the special area management plans around the country, advanced identification disposal areas around the country, other impromptu or informal watershed efforts around the country, and a lot of effort was just spent early on, often not a month, but a year or 2 years, just trying to figure out what type of information was needed to inform a watershed-based logic. A tremendous amount of time just dealt with that issue, not only the metrics you were going to use, but what information did you need? So we're going to take a look at information that's needed in terms of making watershed-based decisions. Well, I'm going to borrow from John Muir, and he made a quote, or he stated in my first summer in the Sierra 1911, when we try to pick out anything by itself, we find it hitched to everything else in the universe. So, and this quote was actually in the first chapter, the top of the first chapter in the report that just came out from the NRC. Some of you may be familiar with the 2016 peer review study of the core. And one of the four elements in the report that just came out last month, or this month actually, I think, was on river basin and coastal systems planning. And that quote was at the top, so it was meant to say that we need to take a systems, or if you will, a watershed system approach to how we manage water resources or aquatic resources. But I'll read it again. When we try to pick out anything by itself, we find it hitched to everything else in the universe. I'm going to use it for a different purpose. That is, we paid for y'all to come. What we're going to do is pick on you, and we want to remain hitched to you. So I'll have a picture of you of John Muir's quote. So anyway, thank you all for coming. Any questions? Yes.
What was the origin of the mitigation action plan group?
What
caused the federal agencies to get together to form the mitigation action? Was it a congressional mandate, or the agency heads got together and said we need to do this?
This was as close to an example of a staff-generated initiative as there has been, and this was a combination of agency folks that were excited about the opportunity to do something good, particularly in light of the platform that the results of the National Academy of Sciences study had provided. So essentially the agencies got together over the course of several months and put together a plan in draft form that we felt would achieve some of the and address some of the concerns that had been raised as a result of those reports, and we briefed our respective management, and they were likewise happy to see something like that move forward.
It's not in your conference materials, but we have copies of the action plan.
I was going to add to that informality and communication and just familiarity, actually, most, I think, has helped contributed to it. We had a White House Wetlands Working Group that formed in the mid-90s to help to come up with the mitigation, national mitigation banking guidance. And this group continued to meet. A couple of us are still around from the early groups. Two of us in this room that I see. I think Susan, Marie, and I think are the only ones that are vestige, the only one residual from the very earliest group. But we continued to meet on other issues. NWB guidance was one of the next major issues. And this informal group, if you will, maybe early on it was semi-formal, but this informal working group continued to meet. And so I think it's a case of communication, familiarity, and realizing that we could come up and do good work in this sort of a forum. And so I think that this was just, and so when the when the Corps issued its regulatory guidance letter on Christmas Eve 2002, the mitigation action plan was also released at the same time, and they had been worked on communally by the same group. So it's a case of familiarity and common sense.
Does anyone want a copy of the action plan? We have copies of it. Can you raise your hands real quick? And there's more copies in the back there. You can keep your hands up. And you can keep asking questions.
Sure. Molly?
Well, I have not a question, but a statement.
No.
As a representative of the regulatory group, the people are sitting at their desk actually writing permits. And there's about six people that I can identify in this room who have actually written permits before, and there may be more. but that this, everything that we're working at, I just want people to keep in mind that there are different levels of different target audiences for this. So there are people, regulators with 30, who knows how many permit actions more roughly.
150.
And under their name, it doesn't mean you're worse than 150 at any one time. But there's, you know, you're looking at the permit, you're looking at what this project has and what you can do to issue this permit in the next month or whatever. And so it's, generally speaking, not possible for the actual project manager to go put together a watershed plan before issuing a permit. So when we're thinking, and I've already said this to a number of people in here, but I just want to have people keep in mind that there are things that a regulator has a decision to make. There may be a progression of thinking that can happen in issuing a specific permit. And also there are other things that we can relate to, such as regional general permits, which may be associated with a watershed plan. There may be a SAMP or something, but in most cases, I would say in the 90 percentile of permits that are actually issued in this country, there is no watershed plan. And there's not likely to be a watershed plan in the near future. So when we're thinking about what can happen in regulatory, on one hand we're talking about the specific day by day, on the other hand, we're talking about what will be very nice to do to the extent that we can encourage it.
Thank you. Any other questions?
The NRC report basically said, you know, we need to take a watershed approach, but it recognized the fact that, you know, SAMP's been around since the 1980s letter, and so EPA has been around for a while, EPA doing much work, especially in the southeast, and so these are recognized, but for very for failure, but it was maybe a groping or learning process. But the NRC report acknowledged that you were going to have plans in many parts of the country. Some parts of the country don't like plans per se. Others are more conducive to plans.
Strategy, that's the word you use.
And the nature of those plans has a lot to do whether they're accepted or not, whether they're generic or lines on the sand, so to speak, or lines in the mud. Had a lot to do with whether plans are litigated. But the NRC report recognized that and said, we're not proposing it. The NRC report basically was after a logic, if you will, and it gave some things that proponents could do, that regulators could do to implement a watershed approach. Now, the watershed approach, whether it's EPA or the Corps, environmental operating principles and watershed guidance, it implies within the concept of a watershed approach is the concept of dealing with stakeholders, communication, outreach. In other words, being integrated, looking at a system, and involving the values of the local populace. All of these sorts of things are inherent in the EPA's approach and the Corps' guidance and principles. So it recognizes that, and the NRC report also stressed that. So what we're here, if you look at that first charge, was to identify criteria that might be used. That's the prime thing. We're not proposing that, because we couldn't get there, that we're giving tools that have been used, tried and true, that you might be able to apply depending on the situation in terms of a formal plan, semi-formal, in many cases informal plans. For example, Southeastern Virginia has a series of informal, there are agency plans, but they're informal, that different people have bought on, but there's no official watershed plan. These are used to make them hunt for mitigation decisions. There are lots of these sorts of cases. So the thing, the main thing out of here, primarily, would be coming up with criteria. What types of criteria in formal logic? Just like there's an HGM logic, I'll give you an example. There's an 800G market classification. There's also a logic to applying that. There's a logic behind it that can help regulators in terms of interpreting or knowing or interpreting what that side is. Well, I would say the same thing in terms of the watershed logic. We're looking for that sort of a framework.
Let me just make sure I caught Molly's point. In 90% of the cases when permits are issued, there will not be a watershed plan in place. There will be one in the near future. Kind of wanted to put that in context.
So that's a totally limited percentage.
Right, I know. The vast majority of the three scientists are going to say anything too definitive, right?
Yes.
Okay, I just want to make sure we capture that.
Two things, Bob. Palmer and I are very concerned about your walking back and forth across that across that wire, because we're make a sort of a counter argument as one of those people who does who has written a fair share of permits
and manages a group of about 100 people that are processing about 10,000 permit applications a year, I don't think we can continue to exist as a regulatory agency without something like this to help us. There's a lot more that can come out of a watershed approach to our business than just figuring out where to place mitigation. You mentioned regional general permits, but one of the things we're doing in my district, Jacksonville District, is actually we've broken Florida into 28 watersheds. We're preparing watershed profiles on those 28 watersheds. We're actually in the process of allocating resources to the watersheds where we have the most activity. And one of the things that we, I think, need, especially in a command and control regulatory program, by and large, command and control regulatory programs are fairly mindless. You know, they have criteria that have to be met, and if you meet them, you get the permit. Okay? That's the simple way a command and control regulatory program is designed to operate. You meet the criteria, you get a permit, right? I mean, that's the way NPDES works. That's the way TMDL is going to work. We have to do it because right now it ultimately it will save us work.
Let me make sure we get back to this comment. Now getting back to what Bob said, and of course Molly, there is a logic flow that can be informed decision making. The other thing that could help, and I think will help, is information transfer. It's not necessarily the core, but it's essentially the core through the state agencies local, is that information transfer is Josh's organization creating websites that provides your project managers with information that's nicely formatted along logic flow so they don't have to gather information. You could look at the San Francisco Bay, you can see restoration opportunities, you can see that. And then using that information, apply the logic, so then I think if we can...
So increase the information...
So it's information, it's the logic plus the information exchange that I think will make this happen. Information. Provide the individual with those tools.
So information flow and...
Might be the logic. So his logic, organizing the information flow. Maybe Josh, I don't know.
Information flow and the logic will make it all. Any other comments? And then, okay. Josh?
The logic train makes a lot of sense to me, but in most of these workshops, I see myself pulled along two different tracks. One is indicated by how do we make the work more efficient? How do we get the permits out of time? How do we serve client applicants? And the other is almost theoretical scientific logic. And those two may be divergent or convergent, depending upon the people in the room. But I think today we'll see ourselves developing two different kinds of logic. What is supported by science? And what is needed in terms of regulatory applications?
So I think that's a really good point because Eli did three research projects to prepare for this, and one of them, all three of them, in your conference. The studies we did in all of these around the country, many of them were developed kind of in an academic setting or removed from an actual on-the-ground setting, and some of them in a regulatory sense. So that's an issue that we're going to definitely address, primarily on the third day, but you know, bridging that, because you're right, there are, in many cases, the on-the-ground reality of how this is going to be happening, and then versus these tools that are being developed.
Just the final statement was that's what's attractive about watershed, because intuitively, by self-evidence, that is the scale at which those two tracks begin to converge.
So the watershed approach.
You see, so we're hoping it works that way. And then nicely, since watersheds are nested, you can sort of scale up and down based upon your clientele. But it's yet to be shown, at least from our neck of the woods, that we can put that into effect.
Any other questions?
Two more.
Raise your hand so I can get a cue going. Alan.
Anybody's been doing the regulatory process for a number of years, they're dropping out of the line. What a great mitigation site. And then sometimes a permit applicant comes in and says, yeah, I want to do this, and I'm going to go to Inland Fiat. You know, for less money, I bet you can go over and coach that landowner and do that. And I've done it on another number of occasions and tied up miles of river system and restored their adjacent wetlands. I mean, I think that's the kind of stuff we're trying to do here for the function back into the system level. So, yeah, although it's not written down, the plans exist in somebody's head.
So we have BPJ. So maybe yeah. we're in mm-hmm. a structured BPJ,
sure.
if you will.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mark?
I've got three short comments, and I'll try not to say too much because I don't want to make people think. One, number one, I agree with John 100%. We have to go there, and my job as the chief regulator is to get us there without causing undue time, data, and money on the district. So that's why I plugged EPA to get some money for the job. So we are moving that direction, and that's that. And John is exactly what we're viewing from headquarters. Mm-hmm. So that John is espousing not only the Jacksonville, but that's the way we're going with the entire core program. So that's it. Second question is, and while I agree on the watershed thing, but the two things, getting the permits out faster and the science, there's another part of that getting the permits out faster. Part of doing this thing is with better environmental documentation and better environmental decisions. So it's not just more permits faster, it's a better environmental analysis before you make those permit decisions.
Better documentation.
Yes. Well, no, it's not just documentation, but having more information. So, for example, we're talking about this not decision tools per se, but more screening tools mm-hmm. for these types of things. So that if yeah. you have some automated tools, so if you get a hit, you have to do more analysis. So you're able to screen for more environmental issues at the same time getting, you know, we'll get more permits out faster, but to have better environmental decisions. We won't forget to hit something or miss something or have better analysis, say, hydrology or other issues. And, you know, and again, it's to make the project manager's job easier so they have more time to do the initial analysis. And the third thing, just to make sure I've heard a couple of people talk about clients, we're applicants. We don't have customers. We don't have clients. We have applicants for the regulatory program. That doesn't mean we don't treat them with respect and dignity and everything else, but they don't pay us for anything. We're not proponents or opponents of projects. So they're applicants. I just want to make that clear to everybody.
Eric?
My comments are kind of following up on John and Josh's. The experience that we had in Eugene, this is back in the late 80s and early 1990s, and we still face it in different issues as well. We as a program tend to think along the lines of ecologically what makes the most sense, and then we try to work with the regulatory agencies to get them to buy into what we're trying to do. What we found over the past is that even within the regulatory agencies, there's typically kind of a planning branch and a regulatory branch. We almost always have no problem with the people in the planning branches supporting the permits. and even when we have the head of the planning branch, and even maybe just a field staff for our local area there, the field staff, you know, routinely is very uncomfortable with what we're talking about, even though if you took that person out of the room and said, you know, ecologically, what we're doing here is way better than what your regulatory framework is going to allow. So let's come up with a new regulatory framework that's allowed under our state regulations. And ultimately, we did that in a big scale, but I would hate to see everybody have to go through the four-year planning process. And even still, even now that we have a program in place and policies in place, we still face that. When new staff come in, they're like really freaked out by what we're doing.
So you're just kind of integrating planning and regulatory approaches to the challenge.
It's a challenge. It's something that I'm hoping that this whole thing will work out so nationwide, those type of issues will be addressed within the state and federal agencies.
Let's just take a few more questions and then we're going to move on here. Sherry?
Yeah, follow up on the administrative side of this. As a project applicant, vast amounts of money and energy go into making environmental documentation and packaging it for one person to review. And another model to look at would be to not pay all those consultants all that money to repeat the thing on similar projects nearby, but put the money into experts who review things as a team or a panel with the multidisciplinary approach, rather than cramming all this into a document. So it's kind of a challenge for the regulators to think of what the applicant.
So the resources should go more into review.
More like expert panels, permitting teams. When you get into this multidisciplinary watershed approach, you either have to cram it all in a document and get one person to get it right, or bring those experts to the table to review different aspects.
Before I let John and Bob go, we can have a lot of time for this kind of discussion. I just want to see if anyone has any questions directly for them before they sit down.
Any final question as to what we're here for?
The desired outcomes.
We're going to go over here a lot more about them. So. anything more for them? Okay.
Great.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.